Welcome to this week's Science Podcast. I'm Alison Richards, NPR Science Editor. This week, we'll hear about the oil spill and the shadow it's cast on government plans for more offshore drilling. We also look way back in time. Scientists have sequenced the Neanderthal genome. But first, we look at our own future, specifically whether we can do anything to help prevent Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's and the question of whether we can do anything to keep it at bay was taken up last week by a panel at the National Institutes of Health. We've all heard that if we eat well, exercise, and perhaps do that extra crossword to keep mentally fit, we can fend off dementia. But the expert panel found otherwise. They announced that there's not much you can do to prevent the disease, though some researchers found that view a little extreme. NPR's John Hamilton reports.
At about the time the panel was releasing its report, a 78-year-old senator was doing something he hopes is good for his brain.
And here comes Senator Richard Lugar 29 times in a row, running strong after 29 years.
Lugar was competing in an annual charity race a few miles from Capitol Hill. He's been a runner since grade school and thinks exercise helps him remember a lot of stuff.
The names and places of thousands of people and events that I bring up frequently in the course of debate. It's very helpful to have that kind of historical knowledge of my constituency as well as of the world.
The panel convened by the NIH wasn't so sure that's why people like Lugar remain sharp into their 70s and 80s. And they wanted to make sure the public wasn't being misled about the benefits of this or any other strategy for preventing Alzheimer's. So the panel looked only at studies in humans. And they found some studies of exercise in people have found a benefit, while others haven't. Arthur Kramer, a neuroscientist from the University of Illinois, wasn't on the panel, though he was invited to speak to the group. He says the panel is right to be cautious. But he says there are reasons researchers talk about the potential of exercise.
The benefits tend to be on the order of a 20 to 30% reduction in being diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease and other such diseases. And again, this isn't universal, but this is found in increasing number of studies.
Kramer says researchers also tend to consider studies that show what exercise does for animals.
There are improvements in the chemistry of the brain in terms of the molecules that protect the brain, increases in the number of connections between neurons, and even the birth of new neurons in one region of the brain that supports memory.
Mental exercise is another strategy that seems like a good idea to many Alzheimer's researchers. After all, it appears to increase connections in the brain and make the brain more resilient in animals and perhaps in people. But Neil Buchholz from the National Institute on Aging says the panel would need a lot more than that to recommend a specific activity to the public.
Doing crossword puzzles or Sudoku, those kinds of things. They're interesting, but the evidence is not available at this point that they actually have an effect.
The panel seemed most skeptical about studies of drugs, diets, and nutritional supplements. Members found some evidence of benefit from omega-3 fatty acids, like those in fish, but it found no convincing studies in people that antioxidants like vitamin E could make a difference. Martha Claire Morris is less skeptical. She's a nutritional epidemiologist at Rush University Medical School in Chicago who was invited to speak to the panel. Morris says there is good evidence that some antioxidants work in animals.
There's a very broad base of animal models to show that vitamin E protects the brain from neuron loss, from DNA damage, from oxidative damage.
Panel members say they'll consider changing their position on vitamin E and other popular prevention strategies when researchers show they work in people. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Now to oil. Earlier this year, President Obama announced plans to open up drilling to areas that had been off limits. Now, the federal government and states are stepping back and trying to assess what should come next. Here's Christopher Joyce.
Days into the oil spill, President Obama said he still supports offshore drilling so long as it's done responsibly and doesn't damage the environment. For California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Gulf spill fails on both counts. Schwarzenegger announced that he's yanking approval of an offshore drilling project along his coastline because he no longer believes the assurances of the oil industry.
Despite those studies and support, all of you have seen when you turn on the television that the devastation in the Gulf. And I'm sure that they also were assured that it is safe to drill. It would not happen here in California.
It was in California in 1969 that the mother of all U.S. rig spills occurred, just off the coast of Santa Barbara. Images of oil-soaked birds and beaches helped launch Earth Day and the modern environmental movement. Another hotspot in the offshore drilling debate is Florida. The state legislature is weighing a measure to open up new areas for offshore drilling. Susan Glickman, a consultant for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, says some Floridians had come around to the idea because of the country's dependence on foreign oil, but the spill appears to have trumped that concern.
There has been a definite switch in positions for some and a hardening of positions for others, you know, against drilling, which for a brief period of time was enjoying some increase in the public support and political support, but that is evaporating rather quickly.
Among the converts who switched from pro to con is Florida Governor Charlie Crist, who flew over the oil spill and decided Florida wasn't ready for new drilling. In Washington, D.C., expanded offshore drilling has won backing from quite a few stalwart environmentalists in the Senate who are pushing a new energy and climate bill up a very steep hill. The bill offers support for more offshore drilling and new nuclear power plants as a sweetener to win votes from skeptics who say the bill will raise consumers' energy costs. Former Colorado Senator Tim Wirth, who now heads the United Nations Foundation, says he expects the oil spill will upset the political apple cart in the Senate.
I think that there will be a number of coastal people who were previously supporting the bill who will want provisions related to aggressive drilling taken out of the bill.
Wirth says other senators who were on the fence are now likely to jump off onto the no new drilling side. The spill doesn't mean an end to offshore drilling. Large parts of the Gulf of Mexico are and will continue to be exploited. The Interior Department has leased many sites still waiting to be explored. But Wirth points out that these sites have to be carefully evaluated. British Petroleum site, for example, was unusually deep and technically difficult. He says the drilling industry had assured skeptics that new technology made it doable and safe.
I think the time has come to carefully examine the technologies that are now far out in front of our ability to manage those technologies.
The spill has galvanized those who fought against new offshore drilling, but Phil Sharp, a former U.S. congressman and head of the economics think tank Resources for the Future, says all Americans, politicians and consumers alike, should consider where the demand for new oil comes from.
It's a little bit disingenuous on our parts if we ethically think, oh my goodness, we're going to protect the environment, we're not going to allow drilling, but we're just going to consume to our heart's content.
Especially, he says, if drilling for oil beyond American shores is less regulated and even more hazardous to the environment than it is here. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
If you've ever called someone a Neanderthal, well, it turns out you may have been right. At least in part. A new study shows that some modern humans do indeed have Neanderthal genes. DNA from bones over 35,000 years old reveals that Neanderthals, a relative of ours that went extinct, did interbreed with some modern humans who were around at the same time. NPR's Joe Parker explains.
It's extremely likely that modern humans and Neanderthals bumped into each other once upon a time.
The archaeological record shows they overlapped between about 30 and 80,000 years ago.
David Reich is a geneticist at Harvard Medical School. There's some fossil evidence that they may have done more than shake hands in passing, but the initial genetic evidence suggested otherwise.
And so the big open question was whether they exchanged genes during that time when they overlapped in the Middle East and in Europe.
We're not talking about exchanging genes as in exchanging trading cards. We're talking about had sex together.
That's right.
Glad we cleared that up. As hard as it may be to believe, fragments of DNA can survive in bones more than 30,000 years old. And scientists from the Max Planck Institute in Leipzig, Germany, have now completed a draft sequence of the 3 billion letters of Neanderthal DNA. Modern humans moved out of Africa about 80,000 years ago, after Neanderthals had already settled in Europe and elsewhere. So if Neanderthals contributed genes to modern humans, it would have been after those humans had left Africa. So Reich compared Neanderthal DNA with modern African and non-African DNA, and found that the non-African DNA was more related.
The non-African is more closely related to the Neanderthal, quite definitely, highly statistically, significantly, overwhelming evidence that they're more closely related on average to Neanderthals.
In other words, Reich and his Leipzig co-authors are totally sure that Neanderthal genes found their way into modern humans when the two species crossed paths. They report their findings in the journal Science.
The simplest possible explanation is that it occurred once, but it very easily could have occurred on multiple occasions, and perhaps it's likely that it occurred on multiple occasions.
Reich says it's hard to pin down exactly how much DNA Neanderthals contributed to modern humans.
We estimate about 1 to 4% of the genetic ancestry of non-Africans is from Neanderthals.
And just to be clear, Reich says there's no stigma to have a bit of Neanderthal heritage.
Absolutely not. And in fact, people who have Neanderthal DNA have done just fine in our society.
Now that they have the sequence, scientists can start looking for regions of DNA that differ between Neanderthals and modern humans, the genetic stuff that makes us, us.
And then once the regions are identified, look to see, well, what genes are here? What biological sense can we make of this?
Richard Green recently left Leipzig to join the faculty of the University of California, Santa Cruz. He says they've already begun to identify genes that have changed during human evolution.
Which one of these happened very recently, since we split even from Neanderthals, and which ones of these are much older and happened in the 6 million years or so since we diverged from chimpanzees?
Already, the Neanderthal DNA has shown that genes involved in wound healing, sperm swimming, and hair shape have all changed fairly recently. Having the Neanderthal sequence is like having a totally new perspective on ourselves. John Hawkes is an anthropologist at the University of Wisconsin. Hawkes says it's like the first time humans were able to look back at the Earth from beyond Earth's orbit.
We can say, here's a picture of what we are from the outside, from the distant past, and we can use that to get a new picture of what we are. It's amazing. I mean, it is really, I can't express how I feel this morning. It's really cool.
An exciting time to be a modern human anthropologist studying human origins. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
And finally, an easy way to resolve troubling thoughts. Well, maybe. Lady Macbeth, you may recall, tried to ease her conscience by cleaning invisible bloodstains off her hands. But she may have been onto something. Nell Greenfield Boyce explains that soaping up may be good for your mental health.
A few years ago, scientists discovered the Macbeth effect. Hand cleaning seemed to ease the guilt people felt after being asked to recall something unethical they'd done in the past. This fascinated Spike Lee. He's a psychology researcher at the University of Michigan, who wondered if hand washing could influence emotions beyond a sense of moral purity. After all, people have this idea of starting over with a clean slate.
Maybe there's a broader phenomenon here. Anything from the past, any kind of negative emotional experiences, might be washed away.
He and a colleague named Norbert Schwartz decided to see if they could wash away one kind of bad feeling, the lingering unease we feel after being forced to choose between two attractive options. Lee says psychologists know that people usually try to soothe this inner conflict by later exaggerating the positive aspects of whatever it is they chose.
In other words, after they make the choice, they will like the chosen option more than before the choice.
The researchers figured that people wouldn't need to do this kind of justification if hand washing could relieve their tension instead. To test this idea, the researchers first asked students to rate a list of music CDs. They then offered the students two of the CDs and told them to select one as a take-home gift. Afterwards, some students lathered up with soap. Others only looked at the soap or sniffed it. As the researchers had suspected, those left with dirty hands later gave their chosen CD a higher score than they had on the initial ranking. But the hand washers didn't.
They feel no need at all to justify the choice.
The hand washers ranked their chosen CD pretty much as they had before. In the journal Science, the researchers report that they saw the same effect in a similar experiment that let people use antiseptic wipes.
Apparently, you do not need water and soap.
Norbert Schwartz says, on the one hand, so to speak, washing may help decision makers by rinsing away mental turmoil. But on the other hand,
we may not do you a favor when you wash your hands and you're not doing that cognitive work to make your decisions appear in the best possible light.
Schwartz says it may be that if people don't justify their choices, they may end up feeling more remorse in the long run. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
And that's it for this week's Science Podcast. You can go to npr.org for more science stories, and we'll be back next week. I'm Alison Richards. Thanks for listening.